Black Mirror Bandersnatch is over. Or is it? But we are just getting started. Here at Post Show Recaps, my name is Jessica Leese. And friends, I have to tell you, earlier today, I was given the option, record a podcast with Rob Cesternino, record a podcast with Mike Bloom. And I chose to record a podcast with Rob Cesternino. And then I ended up murdering my family and getting sent to prison. And Post Show Recaps got deleted from iTunes. Everybody gave it 0 stars. And so I said, that won't do. I got to go back. I got to do it differently, choose a new path. And so I have chosen to discuss everything that happened in this very strange Netflix experiment with the one and only Mike Bloom. Hello, Mike. How are you?
Sorry, mate. Wrong choice.
All right. Well, let's just skip ahead then.
Yeah, this is where we bring Antonio Mazzaro on, and I wind up going in someone and say, yeah, Jess, I think we podcasted about this before, and then you insist that we never have. It does seem about right that I end up sort of being the leftover option, but I am here to reap all the rewards and all the star ratings, no matter how numerous they may be or lack thereof, to talk about what was truly a wild way to end 2018 / begin 2019, depending on when you actually dived into this.
Yeah, it certainly bridged the years in a strange and wonderful way. So, Mike, I thought maybe as we go through all of these things, the first thing we have to do is click through the part where we give a spoiler warning. So anybody right now, I assume that you have watched a few iterations of Bandersnatch by the time you're getting around to listening to podcasts about it. But I just want to warn all the listeners out there that we are going to go deep. We're going to talk about endings you may not have seen. The version you saw is obviously may not be exactly the same as the one Mike saw, and definitely not the same one as the one I saw. So if you are okay with potentially getting one of the alternate paths of Bandersnatch spoiled for you, then proceed. And if not, you can just click out of here and opt to do something else. And that's about all I have to say about this. We're going to spoil everything, and we're going to spoil it hard. And the way I figured we'd talk about this is we kind of have some different topics of discussion to bring into this podcast. And I thought I might let Mike step into the role of the omniscient Netflix chooser and steer us in the direction we want to go. How do you like that, Mike? Yes or no?
I'm on to this, Jess. I've watched enough of Bandersnatch to know that I truly have no choice, that, you are also like 2.5 timesing the actual output of Netflix, considering you're giving me what, like 5 choices instead of 2 outright.
Well, that's true, but we can start with 2 choices to keep it simple, and it can be like in Bandersnatch itself, where there may be 4 paths you can take, but only 2 of them are going to show up on screen at any given time.
So you're saying that 2 might just get cut out of the podcast altogether, only you and I will know about it?
Right. We had to kind of cut off some pathways because it was just getting way too complicated.
Yeah, I mean, that's very understandable. All right, I'm ready to make a choice. I will say at the top here, I am someone who has been dealing a lot with my own mental health and sense of anxiety in the past year, and I will say Bandersnatch, for what it's worth, a pretty nice coping mechanism for someone who has a lot of trepidation in making choices, considering that, a choice will be made for you no matter what, and pretty much no matter what option you choose, it's going to be horrible, and that somehow is a pretty settling option for someone who constantly experiences that feeling on the day-to-day.
Yeah, well, I've been hearing the running joke. I think everybody has made this joke at this point, but the person we all want to see watch Bandersnatch is Chidi from The Good Place.
Absolutely. Though, I mean, that man will then put like Tums and any antacid companies out of business with just the pure stomach aches that will be occurring by the cereal choice alone. So it's a little bit of a schadenfreude, which is apropos given the nature of The Good Place. No spoilers, but yeah, I think that's if we're doing some TV crossovers here, Black Mirror is apparently setting itself up for a lot of crossover. Let's just bring in some other, Good Place stuff as well. It truly is, if we're talking about purgatorial natures that exist within the Black Mirror universe, I think it makes sense.
Yeah, I think we all kind of go to the bad place no matter what when it comes to this story. So, Mike, do we want to talk about the narrative universe in which this whole thing dwells? Or do we want to talk more about the storytelling style first? Your choice.
Oh, boy. All right. Let's I think we should start with the storytelling device, because I think that is the big to do about the first foray into Black Mirror's filmmaking. And for some, it may be the stopping point when it comes to praise about Bandersnatch in particular. For some, it's just a jumping off point. So I would love to hear your thoughts as to, now that you've sort of taken a whole deep breath of the way this story is told, as to, you know, what your initial reactions to it are to it and how you feel about it, you know, several days after taking in all the content.
Well, it's weird because I think this might have been, and I've seen this reaction leveled at the show quite a bit over the last couple of days, but I am inclined to say that if this was just one piece with no paths, I'd probably watch it once and kind of forget it and go on to the next Black Mirror episode fairly quickly. I think as a standalone Black Mirror episode without these different pathways and without this deep immersive universe with one outcome, it's kind of eh. It's an okay, like, I'm not completely turned on by the idea of a young computer whiz kid building a role-playing game and then going insane by it. It's sort of immaterial. It is the style that I think is the headliner and the thing that makes this entire universe stick in your head so hard.
Mm. Yeah, what I would say is, I mean, maybe I'll cop a phrase from Rob Cesternino, whose echoes of his alternative universe are maybe echoing in my head. This felt like a lot of sizzle and not a lot of steak, to sort of go off of what you were saying there. Because I do have a lot of agreement that I think the actual plot itself, there are some really fun things to mine out of there, which we'll certainly talk about. And of course, you know, in the days where nostalgia is king, which are the 2010s, having the nice 80s throwbacks complete with the music and the, you know, the TV and video game references and everything is a lot of fun. But if you look at the plot itself, it's not exactly a huge gripping thing to, you know, hang some interest off of, especially when you're going through it multiple times, as I'm assuming we and a lot of people out there were want to do. I had a lot of fun with it going through the first time, maybe the first couple of hours. And then when I went through it to sort of explore the other options in anticipation for this podcast, that's when I'm sort of hitting the skip ahead 10 seconds, especially in that prologue when it's going to be the same setup each and every time unless you reset it and then things are a bit different, which I'm sure we can talk about. But what I will say on the positive side is I think if they're going to continue with this format, I think this is a great start. I personally think that, as weird as it is to say, they are trying out this uber experimental format. Maybe they're going for a bit of a basic storyline, one that is not necessarily too far, quote unquote, out there, even if it does involve an acid trip and multiple timelines and possible time travel. I think we, you know, depending on the reception behind this overall and Netflix's willingness to go ahead with it, I think we could see something in the foreseeable future, something as wild as like a white bear scenario, which will have its own connections that I'm sure we're going to be talking about with this mechanism attributed to it. I think that as much as we might talk about the various paths, it does sort of revolve around a few set options. I know there's a lot of debate as to the number of true endings. I think people have sort of settled around like there are 10 really big outcomes, and it always seems like it sort of hones back to those 10 no matter what. I could see a future where the success of this warrants an opportunity to make an even more complicated story. This is like the 2.5-star version of a Black Mirror episode where they're saying like, yeah, this is a lot of fun. You know, there were some rote choices and things might have been a bit on autopilot, but it was an enjoyable experience overall. I think now this was a good jumping off point. I think we possibly have the potential to make the complete 5-star bananas complex tree diagram of choices involving the bleak Black Mirror scenarios we know and love.
Well, let's hope that that doesn't drive anybody to murder. Because I, from what I hear, the setup on this and the putting it all together and making it seamless and complex and hiding all the Easter eggs, I read an article in the Hollywood Reporter this week that alleges that the complexity of just this one episode is delaying the entire rest of the Black Mirror season.
Yeah, and I'm sure people who did not really enjoy Bandersnatch are thrilled to hear that this entire project was pushing back some more episodes of the series, which, as we know, just to sort of lay down the groundwork as to the information about season five, because I think there are some people that count this as like season five, episode zero. Some are just counting this as a standalone thing. But I do believe Charlie Brooker said that there are season five episodes coming in 2019. It just might be a bit later than expected because of the project that this was. I think I read the same article as you, Jess. I think Brooker said this was like the same amount of work as four regular Black Mirror episodes, which makes sense from a pure writing perspective alone.
Yeah, dude's going to have to change his name to Charlie R.R. Brooker.
Exactly. Look, he's pumping things out, okay? And there's no analogs. If there's a literary version of the Black Mirror episodes that go past the Brooker universe, I think maybe the comparisons could be warranted. But as far as I know, Charlie Brooker is not fond of hats nor big white beard, so I think we're okay.
This is like a whole Black Mirror episode in and of itself. Like, he just gets so far down the rabbit hole this one episode that it takes him four times as long as it would to create a normal episode. And then the other episodes get delayed. And then there's a book of it that goes beyond everything else. And, you know, the fourth wall gets broken and he fights the therapist. And
I mean, yeah, he basically is like the Jerome F. Davies at this point as well, which I enjoyed the name, but I will say the Losty in me got his name confused many times with Jeremy Davies. Yeah. Also known as the great Daniel Faraday.
Well, there are so many things that made me think of Lost throughout this that I'm prepared to say right now that Jeremy Davies could be like the long lost brother of Jerome Davies.
I mean, the saner brother. And I think that is saying something. Yeah. I don't think Jeremy Davies is shanking anybody in a dream anytime soon.
Yeah, maybe they're fraternal twins.
That would be an interesting Black Mirror episode too. Jerome F. Davies and Jeremy Davies facing off against each other. Maybe they can have sort of a crossover with Dermot Mulroney and Dylan McDermott as to like the name alike. You know, when you have a twin in this dystopian paradise that you're going to have to kill who has a very similar name as yours.
Well, we already know how the Paxton Pullman one got resolved.
Yeah, actually, that's very true. One declared independence from another on a day that shall live in infamy. But I guess I want to go back to this because, I mean, this trailer was dropped, I think, what, the day before the actual film had dropped. And, you know, I think there was some leakage on the internet as to some new Black Mirror coming. But did you know anything about how this was going to work before you actually started watching Bandersnatch?
No, I had absolutely no idea. And in fact, you and I were texting about this before we watched it. And you said, hey, check it out. The trailer dropped. And so I watched the trailer and I'm like, oh, this looks so cool. It's retro 80s. And this guy's a video gamer. And there's like a suspense angle. Where is he going to get sucked into the book? And I had no idea there was a whole choose-your-own-adventure component. I'm like, yeah, this looks cool. I'm hyped for it. And then I started watching it, and the choices started coming up, and it was like, okay, this is potentially even cooler, and it's such a neat device. Even if the story kind of gets a little bit out of my realm of what I might choose to be the perfect kind of vehicle for this, it was just really fun. And the way that they subvert the whole thing, like this could just be like, this is a reference that's way before your time because it's almost before mine. But there was a video game in the 80s, a big console game called Dragon's Lair.
I'm aware of Dragon's Lair. Again, if you're talking about like hyping up someone's anxiety, telling someone to make what's like dirt daring decisions in half a split second or you lose your quarter and turn into a bag of bones, that just seems like I would not be able to live through the 80s, I think, in a myriad of ways. That might be one of them.
Yeah. Well, as we learned from Bandersnatch, the 80s were a tough time for everybody, but it's similar to, I think it's a similar conceit here where you have that limited amount of time to make the decision and then the FMV starts playing again. And that's what I thought it was going to be. But then you get that first hint of it when you are supposed to choose whether Stefan is going to work at the company or if he's going to refuse the offer. And everybody clicks accept the first time through. But then you click refuse and you see the look on Stefan's face where it's like he wants to accept. And the words that come out of his mouth are, no, sorry, I can't. And then that's your first hint that it's going to get very strange. And that I think it's the first time you're controlling the decisions of the story against the will of the characters in the story. And I think that's such a cool idea that made it more interesting than it might otherwise have been, because I think we've all played our fair share of storytelling narrative tree games in our lives. And this would just be a very well animated one if it wasn't for that idea.
Right. On the note of those video game comparisons, you obviously bring up Dragon's Lair, you know, basically the now defunct Telltale Game Studios essentially sort of made their trademark for several years about these narrative tree games. They were most well known for the Walking Dead series, but they also did Game of Thrones and Batman. I know the Mass Effect video game series is a lot of this. This actually reminded me the most of Heavy Rain or Detroit, specifically, you know, each of those, depending on who dies and what decisions are made, the ending is usually capped off by a news report that sort of recaps exactly what the circumstances are now that certain characters are dead. And that's very familiar in this John Hodgman looking video game reviewer who sort of just sums up, oh, these are the results of the decisions that you / Stefan made, and this is the rating that I'm going to give the game. But to your point, I think that for the first time, you know, those games are promptly put the fourth wall up. Even though you're making the decisions, you're sort of embodying the role of the character, and the character's not necessarily realizing it. I think that where this really shines is how it deals with the super meta, definitively the most meta episode of Black Mirror ever, to the point where they literally break down the fourth wall in one of these possible endings. But it absolutely shines a light back at the people that has been indulging in their content for, you know, four seasons up to this point, and saying, you know, you think you're the one making these decisions, but actually we're the ones providing you with these decisions. And actually our decisions are being informed by, you know, the writers, who are being informed by the Netflix CEOs, who are being informed by the shareholders. So it's really one big sort of circle of us all controlling each other.
Yeah, it's the circle of life.
Well, yeah, life, sure. Lack of life sometimes, but certainly life in a manner of speaking.
Yes, indeed. And they definitely, there are a few different points throughout the story at different points on the decision tree where this is lampshaded in a big way, and sometimes the biggest and most obvious of ways. But I really loved that they brought that element in. And then, like you said, the series has always been very meta, but this is the first time you really directly have your hand in it, where sometimes they're just kind of like pointing at you through the screen and being like, ah, this could be you if technology has its way with you, which is kind of Black Mirror's whole thing. But this is more like, yeah, you're right in it. And you almost start to feel like you yourself are a character in the story.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself by talking about the, I don't want to call it the good ending. I'm going to call it the most Black Mirror-like ending, which is the, I'll call the 5-star Pearl ending.
Yeah.
That feels probably, that's one of the biggest, you know, pointing out at the screen directly at you by saying, you know, oh, you're consuming this, and this was built to be like you were playing the video game. So you're just like someone who was involved there, just playing your game, trapped in your little maze, insert, you know, Colin aphorism here. So it's a really interesting commentary on the note of media consumption and, I guess, creator-character relationship. It reminds me a lot of the Will Ferrell movie Stranger Than Fiction, mm-hmm. or The Truman Show, where someone realizes that, you know, when you're part of a narrative and essentially your whole life has been dictated up to this point, what do you do? Can you do anything? And I think when this episode is strongest is when it really explores all of those sort of permutations of that. I kind of wish we had more time to marinate in that, but I do understand if you want to mix some typical Black Mirror dread and existentialism and darkness in there, you have to tone a bit back on there. You know, it's a tricky balance.
Yeah, and I think in the hands of any franchise other than Black Mirror, we'd see more wildly divergent endings. We would certainly, I think all of the endings that I've encountered are Black Mirror-y in their scope, where I think if you let some other franchise do this, you have one ending where the game is 5 stars and Stefan builds a mansion for his father and he falls in love and has a million kids. And then there's one where, like, the game is released and it's a critical success, but nobody buys it and the franchise goes under. And then there's one where he goes to space, and we'd get a little bit broader with it. So the hyper focus, I think, is more interesting in that way. And also, to your point about Stranger Than Fiction and to some of these other ones that get very fourth wall-y, nothing makes me angrier when I'm reading a book than when I get to the last chapter and the last chapter is the protagonist deciding they need to write a book.
As if to say, oh, this was the book the entire time, the whole Bilbo Baggins of it all.
And reader, that book was the book you're reading now. It makes me so angry. And it's the worst if it's in a memoir and they reach the end of it and they're like, and then I decided to sit down and write the memoir and this is the memoir. And it's like, that is the end of my book report. It's do better, storytellers. Like, seriously. So I kind of had a flash of that when we got to the Pearl ending. But for the most part, I think they subvert that pretty well.
Yeah, it's interesting that you talk about, I guess, the quote-unquote good endings that might come out of previous, you know, other created instances. Because I do feel like Black Mirror has spent the past couple seasons sort of subverting those expectations. You know, between most prominently San Junipero, but even USS Callister and Hang the DJ, I think that they've done a good job of maybe wonking with the formula a bit. So it's not always this dark, bleak ending. And I feel like maybe you could also say that, I mean, I was doing some research today and I found a quiz that's like, what your Bandersnatch ending says about you. And if we're going back to this idea of program and control and that we were the test subjects all along, maybe this is also sort of like, a Rorschach test to say, oh, you know, depending on what you choose, this shows how depraved of a person you are. But I did see some people, at least this was me approaching things initially. Maybe I'm a bit of a softy, but I tried to, you know, make it for the best outcome possible, even though I knew the more juicy conflict lie in the worst options. That's why I, to your point, probably like many people, accepted the offer at first because I thought this is a great opportunity. Yeah, I'm opportunistic. I don't know. This is what he talks about. He talked for the past 10 minutes about how this was his dream. He wants to work there. And that's why it's such a fun rug pull, as you said, when it says, oh, yeah, you know, he made it, but it was a complete flop. And they basically look into the camera and said, all right, well, we better try again. At the moment when it flashes back, it really just sort of makes you twitch a bit. Coupled on top of that is Colin saying, oh, yeah, I know you. And basically him sort of filling in the blanks of the conversation before Stefan can really means that, oh, yeah, you're going to have to get your hands dirty a bit if you want to have a lot of fun with Bandersnatch.
Yeah, well, and Black Mirror had to give you at least a few happy endings recently, or you just assume the worst all the time. Like, you have to have a San Junipero where they get to run off together into the sunset, even though they're dead. And you have to get a sort of a USS Callister where they go off into the great unknown and the Hang the DJ where it turns out they've got a 99% chance of staying together. You have to have those, or every single time you'll assume everybody's going to die or get trapped in a simulation or have some other horrible thing happen to them. And if you don't occasionally give them a happy thing, then it's like, it's a terrible psychological experiment where you just lose hope very fast. So I think you come into Bandersnatch with enough hope that if you do the right things in the right order, you'll get an ending that doesn't totally make you hate humanity. And yet, even the one ending that I might argue is sort of a happy ending ends with him being dead.
Yes, it's very much the like Donnie Darko butterfly effect deleted scenes esque ending of for everyone else to be happy, including Stefan himself. He essentially has to, and this is my interpretation of it, essentially cause a paradox by causing his own death in an alternate timeline, which we can definitely get into. But I mean, on this note of endings, I know we made myriad video game comparisons, but I want to jump into the other big pop culture comparison that I felt was even bandied or bandersnatched about in our Rob Has a Podcast patron group. But Jess, can you talk to me a bit about Choose Your Own Adventure books?
Ah, yes, Mike. We have to talk about Choose Your Own Adventure because this is probably a pop culture reference you are less familiar with.
I will take some, again, some, for the second time, I will take umbrage with that, Jessica Lise. I have read a couple. Admittedly, they were a bit yellowed, but I remember in elementary school, because I believe, from what I'm checking here, I think they published Choose Your Own Adventure books through, like, the late 90s. So I definitely recall reading a few, and that old trick that you tell to no one in particular of, if I kept my thumb on the previous page, that means that even if I get a bad ending, I get to turn back and you choose the other one so I don't die. That counts.
Yeah, that totally counts. But anyway, to wind it back, for people that are Mike's age that didn't maybe visit the library quite as often, Choose Your Own Adventure books published from the late 70s up through, as Mike said, the late 90s, and each one of these books was nonlinear storytelling, and you would read a page, and then at the end of the page, it would give you two choices, and it would say, if you want to go up the stairs into the parlor, turn to page 89. If you would like to go into the kitchen and speak to the maid, turn to page 93. And then you would turn the page, and then the story would continue from there. And a lot of these books, there were actually two different sets of Choose Your Own Adventure books. There was the younger reader set and the more mature reader set, in which you would frequently die. Like, I would say, like, 2/3 of the endings involved you dying in some horrible way and not often with a lot of logic attached, which was kind of where they lost me. I would get really angry if I was, like, trying to solve a mystery or something, and then I'd just turn the page and be like, nope, you should have opened the blue door, not the red door, and now you're dead. That was a lot of Choose Your Own Adventure, and I guess a lot of Bandersnatch. But we were talking a little bit in the Rob is a Podcast patron group about some of our favorites, and the one that stuck out for me, the very first one that came out was called The Cave of Time. And I was probably too young to read this book, because when I first read it, I was maybe like 7 or 8, and that one, you very rarely do not die or get trapped in a past that is not your own. You go into this cave and you can travel through time, and you go down one path and it takes you 4 billion years into the future where the sun has gone supernova, which I used to have nightmares about. And then you'd go down another one and you're like on a train with Abraham Lincoln. So they're a lot of fun. They're a great read. And I think, as we get into a little bit more of the story of Bandersnatch, there's one more Choose Your Own Adventure reference that I definitely have to make to talk about some of these strategies to get through all the different endings. But Choose Your Own Adventure books, this is definitely the closest analog to anything in my experience, because I'm not a big gamer, but I very much responded to this because it reminded me of those.
I'm fearful about you getting on the train with Abraham Lincoln after watching Bandersnatch. He never made it to Gettysburg.
Well, you don't ever actually change history. You have very little agency for being able to travel through time. It's very interesting. Like, the whole quest in that book is to get back to your own time, and they seem not to really care whether or not you prevent Abraham Lincoln from being shot.
That's so interesting, because, I mean, we can definitely, I think, talk a bit later about the ideas of free will that this sort of presents. But I feel like, I don't know, the ideas of free will that this is presenting is a bit different, to me at least, than the concept of free will that I'm used to from your typical time travel, you know, alternate dimension hopping fiction, in that those sort of presented as, if things are going to happen in a certain path, you know, do you have free will to change it? It's which Colin sort of alludes to when they're out on the balcony, like, this path is already set, but the things you do can, you know, change things subtly. It's that 11-22-63 coining of the pass is obdurate. No matter what you can do, this format is already sort of laid out in front of you. This is sort of a different way of looking at it. It's less so that your path is laid out in front of you, so you can't really do anything. It's more so, do whatever you want because there's another universe where a different thing is happening. Or do whatever you want because someone else is making your decisions for you. It's a different way to look at free will that it's new and unexpected, and I'm not entirely sure if I like it, to be quite honest. But I do think that even though this concept of free will is a bit of an umbrella term, this introduces another way to look at this through the eyes of the multiverse theory of it all.
Yeah, it is something that hasn't really been explored to this extent, as far as I know, in this genre. I think 1122-63 actually touches on this a little bit, and I'm thinking about specifically the narrative conceit of the yellow card man who's trying to keep track of all the different timelines, and every time he goes back, it creates a new timeline, and the yellow card man is about to die. So it's kind of like we take that idea and we just run with it. Like, there is no yellow card man. You don't get to know what are on all the other timelines, but they all already exist and you're subtly influencing all of the different ones. And I love the way this comes back into play in a few different places. Like, for instance, if Colin jumps off the balcony, he disappears for the whole rest of that thread. Even if you go back to before he jumps, he still doesn't show up.
But there's also some times where if you make it through to an ending and you jump back, it goes to, you know, it does the sort of like montage through the opening clips. And sometimes Colin is there. And I think he actually tells Stefan, like, hey, you know, I said I'd see you again, which alludes to his line where he tells Stefan, see you around, before jumping off the balcony. And that's another thing about this as well. While replaying it might get a bit trite sometimes, again, especially since you might autopilot through the first bit of it, there are these small cell differences which completely substantiate the length and production time that it probably took to make this, where, you know, you have things like Stefan filling in the blanks of conversations that he already knows about. Like, when he picks up the phone and Thacker's on the other end, essentially says three words and hangs up the phone on him because he knows what he's going to say. Or apparently there's even one time, I didn't get this, where Stefan apparently just, Colin actually just breaks, again, the fourth wall and says, you know what, I'm just gonna help this scene along, and like claps his hands and it jumps to the next scene. So if you're talking about, you know, Easter eggs, of which there are loads upon loads of Easter eggs, there is a bit of replay value in that even the scenes, I mean, I think Dr. Hayes says this beforehand, like, you know, it might be wise to revisit things because you find that they might be different from the way that you left them. And that's sort of these small differences are one sign of that. It's the yellow card man, to your point.
Yeah, it's really quite trippy to go back. I played it all the way through twice. I did it once by myself, and then my husband wanted to watch it. And so, or rather, I made my husband watch it because it's definitely his wheelhouse. And it was interesting to note the tiny ways it changes from viewing to viewing. And when you go back from a soft ending back into the story, how things are a little bit different. And it's really wild to me how much is influencing this game in ways that you couldn't get out of a choose your own adventure book, like flipping back to the page that was there before. It would be like if you were reading the book and you flipped back to the page you were just on, and then all of a sudden the words on that page were different.
And I also want to take this time to commend the Black Mirror production team in a number of ways for the audacity of this idea alone. But I will say the transitions between the decision and whatever choice you go down are seamless, in my opinion. I didn't see any sort of stutter between what you decide, you know, unlike in a video game or like an FMV game like Night Trap for the Sega Genesis, for instance, where they sort of have to take the time to load and then move forward with the choice. It all came out. I mean, they wanted to make it like an interactive movie. It reminds me of this random Futurama episode where in the year 3000, there were interactive movies. Black Mirror, once again, another thing that it predicted. And I think it was like, you know, to have Calculon slay the enemies in a bloody battle, hit one, and to have Calculon do his taxes, click two. It very much felt like that in terms of like, they built out this and filmed this completely cohesive narrative. One thing just naturally segued into the other. And it was brilliantly done from a production perspective, in my opinion.
Yeah, which is why I think about it as a movie and not as a game, because it's so seamless. It really does feel like you're watching the movie without there actually being any kind of transition between decisions. And I think that's really beautiful, but it's also really blurs the lines between what this actually is and how we can talk about it.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess it's a good question. Like, do we still consider this a movie? I'm trying to think about if there's any sort of film analog in terms of interactivity, which I believe this was the first time Netflix was trying this out on an adult program. I believe they've done this for, you know, your kids programs, which is, you know, hey, pick this color, pick this shape, etc. But I mean, this might be hasty for me to say, this is the first piece of movie pop culture I can think of that really is structured like this.
Oh my God. This exists for kids programs. Okay, this is new information. And if I hadn't just gotten that heads up from you, I'd be watching Netflix with my toddler one of these days, and I would be super freaked out.
Do you want to bury the body or chomp up the body?
Yikes, yikes. The third season of Beat Bugs gets real dark, man.
Yeah, exactly. Look, there are a lot of bugs in the game as well, and you have to take out the bugs no matter how many sleepless nights it might take you.
Oh, my God. Oh, wow. I don't want any sort of interactivity in my passive entertainment that I'm giving my child. Okay, I do not want him. I do not want him going too far down these decision trees and watching this glyph. Like, I'm going to come back someday and he's just going to be like staring at the white bear glyph.
I mean, to be fair, I mean, you probably catch your kids staring at something nowadays. You just might substitute a picture of the white bear glyph in there, and then things might go a trip to the south before you even realize it. Just don't keep any glass ashtrays around, and I think you should be fine.
Yeah, well, I already decided on the strength of Bandersnatch that I'm never making him give up his stuffed animal. He can keep that thing for the rest of his life if he wants.
Yeah, I think, you know what? No matter how much ribbing your father-in-law might give, I think it's okay. I also don't know. I don't want to get into your life, Jess. I don't know how much you need to keep a secret room or a locked safe with an alphanumeric code. All of that is coming off a bit suspect. I'll admit, I was a little skeeved out by Stefan's dad to begin with. Maybe it was sort of like the hair pulled back look that really put him on a skeezy level to me. But I was glad to have my suspicions validated in certain strings here.
Only in certain strings, Mike. And to that point, let's clap our hands and skip back to the decision tree, to the very beginning. And you may choose again. Do you want to talk some more about the narrative structure, or do you want to talk about the story?
Let's go into the story. We spend a lot of time in the narrative elements of it all, and I'm sure we're going to tie some more into it. It's going to pop in and out throughout, so I'm ready to move on to something new.
Yeah, I think, and this is a good segue, I think, because we can talk about Stefan and his creepy dad, who mostly just reminded me of Lumberg from Office Space.
Yeah, I'm going to need you to come to the psychiatrist with me. That'd be great.
Yeah. Oh, hey, Stefan, what's up? I'm going to need you to go ahead and decide if you want Sugar Puffs or Frosties, okay?
Listen, I defrosted this mint, so I was wondering if you could come in on a Saturday to help with that.
Wow, we could do this all day.
But by the way, what did you choose at first? I feel like maybe this is the most impactful decision in terms of your personality. What do you remember what the first cereal you chose was?
This is like the BuzzFeed quiz of make all these decisions for Stefan and we'll tell you which ending you get.
I mean, don't be alarmed if there's already like 10 quizzes that exist like that already.
Oh, I'm sure. But at that point, you could just watch the movie again. I believe I chose Sugar Puffs.
Mmm, interesting. I went with Frosties, personally. Maybe it's just because I wanted to show my loyalty to both fast food and a breakout character from the recently finished Survivor Merry Christmas versus Happy New Year. But I also don't know that much about Sugar Puffs, and so I went with sort of like the brand that I knew, even though it goes by an interesting, albeit cuter name overseas.
Yeah, well, I thought the guy in the Sugar Puffs box looked like Gritty.
Yeah, I was going to say, it looks a lot like Gritty's older brother.
Yeah, and I feel like if anybody is going to be the thief of destiny, it's going to be Gritty.
That would be interesting. If Sugar Puff's monster or Tony the Tiger is actually Pax. Tony the Tiger, close enough to the lion-esque demon, so maybe that was sort of surreptitiously put in Stefan's head. Because I'm assuming we can also certainly talk about what we each think was in his head, was not in his head. You know, that's a fun part of all this as well, is that we're seeing this basically through the eyes of someone who is assumingly running off of little sleep and a lot of malnutrition, considering his sunken eyes at a certain point in the film. So you have to also have to regard things as, you know, maybe the things that we're deciding on and we're quote unquote seeing might not necessarily be real, given the amount of creepy dreams this kid seems to have.
Yeah, well, and I think we need to talk about the creepy dreams, because I think this is, to me, is where narratively, the story really starts to fall apart, because I feel like here are points where it's almost like the Black Mirror producers are Stefan saying, but I added a whole government conspiracy branch. And it's like, you don't need that. It's okay. I don't need to have five jump scares where he opens the safe and then the demon kills him.
Yeah, the safe stuff with specifically the demon and Jerome F. Davies, they weren't really doing it for me. Like, when I was going around there, I spent a lot of time around the safe stuff, and I thought, okay, if I enter these, this is going to be a lot of fun. But it really coincided with, as you said, sort of a jump scares, which I am not a big fan of. Thank God I watched this during the daytime. And then the only other times we saw Pax, bum rush Stefan after Colin jumps off the roof, which, interestingly enough, I mean, the LSD that they take is a stamp with a lion head on it. So maybe they were sort of channeling the demon. And as I mentioned before, there's one little dream where I think if you pick up the family photo once Jerome F. Davies, in a dream, Stefan works at his computer, turns around, and Jerome F. Davies shanks him for some reason. But outside of that, there are more invisible presences than anything. So I agree that maybe their visuals there might not necessarily be as hard hitting.
Yeah. And it does sort of, you do sort of want the general idea to be anything he finds in that safe is taking places in his own head, which I think plays into, if you just look at it like outside of Stefan and outside of what you see him do, when you get like through the pack part of the safe where he finds out his dad's been performing experiments on him, and it goes back into Colin's rant about the government pays people to be your relatives, and it's like, oh yeah, you never had a mother, you never had a father, it was all a government experiment. And then the conversation you see Stefan have with his father after he puts that all together is very much like, oh no, this is an unmedicated paranoid schizophrenic. This is exactly the kind of thing they would say. And so it's like, yeah, none of that probably actually happened.
Yeah, it's interesting in that, again, certain paths I think will show Stefan. I think he's unhinged in all of them, but in some they might be more reasoned than others. For example, when he realized that he's on a movie set the entire time, I think that's a bit more of an understandable reaction than, as you said, sort of the way we see his paranoia. Because, I mean, his father isn't necessarily, you know, dropping the guys and saying like, oh, yes, you know about our plan the entire time, comrade. It's just more so like he's a little aghast at what his son is about to do. And also in that moment, you don't get the option to kill dad. He just takes the swing with the ashtray. I think that means to assume that, like, I think Stefan is just completely even beyond choice at this point. He's someone who is completely spun out of control into his own paranoia that it's causing these decisions to happen. But it also connects interestingly back to the toy of it all, because I mean, that's where this idea of time travel really stretches maybe its limit, where Stefan is constantly jumping between his own body and his 5-year-old body, to the point where in one outcome, you're able to change the past. You're able to do what Dr. Haynes said you couldn't do. The past is not immutable. He is able to he is able to find his rabbit and go on the train with his mother. Maybe he sort of comes to the realization that the only way he can be happy is if he dies alongside her, which is both tragic and uplifting at the same time, considering that they're the only two casualties and much fewer than other outcomes.
Well, here's the question, Mike. I think the central question of maybe this entire podcast is, what ending do you think constitutes, quote unquote, winning the game? In other words, what ending is the one that the show wants you to have? Because they say it pretty clearly in one of the paths. Stefan says, I had to decide that this was the ending and just steer people toward that ending instead of sending them off onto lots of different endings.
Right. Yeah. So I think the one you're referring to is the aforementioned Pearl path. And I believe that ended up being actually the biggest two endings were the first two that I got. The very first one in my first time through was the train ending, which cut directly to credits. And then I ended up, you know, futzing around a bit and end up getting to the 5-star ending. But the 5-star ending, I'm assuming, considering that that's the only one that has the typical Black Mirror credits cut in between some of the final stock footage, I'm assuming that is the ending that I think the producers want us to sort of glom around. But I will say the quote unquote happiest ending, which is distinct from the more popular ending or populist ending, is that train one.
Yeah, I'm inclined to believe that the true endings or quote unquote true endings are kind of one of those two. And there are a lot of other endings you can arrive at that then sort of say, hey, that was probably unsatisfying. Why don't you go back and try to get one of these other ones? And I notice, for instance, when I think they're pushing you throughout the entire thing to kill your father and chop up the body. And anytime you start to deviate from that path, it shoots you back into another part of the story and gives you more information that makes you want to do it more.
Yeah, and there's even a decision tree where it says, you know, kill dad or what, like bash dad in the head. And, you know, I even when I was working through it for the first time, like I actually groused out loud to Netflix. I said, like, I don't want to kill my dad. Stop making that happen, until they literally listened to me and made that happen. So, yeah, it is really driving you towards that certain path. And it makes sense because from there, that's when I feel like there's also a lot of trees from there, because that's where, you know, depending on who's alive, you could have Colin come over. You could have Thacker come over. You could have Kitty, Colin's girlfriend, come over in one instance. You can chop up the body. You can bury the body. You can call your psychiatrist. You cannot call your psychiatrist. Like, the meat of the decision nodes actually lie in there, surprisingly, which I guess makes sense. It's the big climax of everything, and it's the first real big brutal thing that Stefan is going to do, where he arguably breaks bad. But yeah, man, they really push you towards that ashtray, forcibly so.
Yeah, and there's a point where they just close off the path, and if you refuse to kill him enough times, you get into the ending where he just does it without you having any input.
Yeah, which again, it's saying, like, you know, if you're not going to do this, I'm going to do it myself. It's akin to when Stefan is having his little pew session with Colin, and Colin says, like, okay, you can take this drug or you won't. Even if you say no, Colin drops it in your drink without realizing it. And it's so interesting that he, which could be said of some of these writers, presents the illusion of choice at first by being like, hey, you know what? It's your choice. Do whatever you want to. And then when you choose the outcome he doesn't want, he says, I forced that choice for you to help you down this path.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's the point where he's supposed to take his pills. And when I reached that the first time, there was no option to do anything except throw the pills away. It said you can flush them or you can throw them away. And it was like, that's a non-choice choice. And I even thought, well, maybe there's a point where that's going to pay off. Like, Stefan's dad's going to discover the pills in the trash can. And so I was like, well, if those are my choices, maybe I should do the one that seems like he might get busted and it might be okay again. So we're going to throw them in the trash can and hope somebody discovers them. And then it turns out, nope, that was not a choice at all. That's just not the option to not take the pills.
Which, again, is a point against Stefan. Like, if your dad was really monitoring you, he would know. You would be, you know, pouring through the trash can every single day to make sure you were taking your pills and staying complacent. But you do bring up a good point that I feel like you behaviorally adapt to watching Bandersnatch, especially after the first couple loops, where you're trying to think two or three steps down the line. You're trying to essentially outfox the writers, mostly in fealty, because they know that's exactly what you're going to do. But you're trying to do your own thing by directing things back to your own outcome and saying, okay, if I do this, then this will happen. You know, I totally agree that when I saw those two choices, I'm like, you flush the pills. You know, when people want to get away with bad things, you don't throw them away. You flush them. So there's no evidence of them. But those opportunities, you know, it's driving towards the same path, because that's when you go follow Colin and go down his own rabbit hole of wackadoo theories. If you go see the psychiatrist first, you have the option of just simply taking your pills. And that's when you get, I don't know, maybe the best, not the happiest, but the best ending, where nobody dies. Colin went to make the game and it ends up being like 2.5 stars, right? They said that he went on autopilot for the second half, as it were. So everyone turns out happy and heads securely on their bodies. But otherwise, you're in for a world of hurt, you and the people around you.
Yeah. I mean, is that the whole lesson? Is the lesson, like, never strive for greatness, like, just strive for good enough or everyone around you will die?
Well, I mean, the first thing you do is, I guess you, is it teaching you don't look a gift horse in the mouth and like, hey, don't accept this big opportunity because essentially your idea is going to get completely whitewashed. Like, it's a really interesting sort of bracing splash of cold water at the very beginning. And it takes very long for you to sort of dry off from those ideas. I wasn't able to dry off until like after the entire thing finished. I really had time to marinate and everything.
Yeah, well, and it's harder to dry off after you've marinated.
Yeah, exactly. Or brine like that mincemeat was doing.
Yeah, no kidding. And boy, that's gross.
Yeah, I mean, he was I think someone pointed out this out on Reddit, though, that it's, if we're going back to Stefan and his relationship with his father, it was a nice like little 3-second scene that represents the relationship to a T, where Stefan's father, albeit he has some stuff on his hands, approaches his son and wants to, you know, to talk about, oh, how did it go? How's everything going? And Stefan sort of like meekly shuffles away, just sort of gives him a few words and then walks away to start working. And again, if we're looking into this as to, you know, how much of this was actually real and how much of this was just going on in the delusions of his head, you could point to that as, well, he might not have been the most mentally stable person to begin with. That was brought up through the conversations with Dr. Haynes, where even though Stefan insists he's getting better, the truth of the matter is they are approaching a really traumatic date and he might, you know, not necessarily be the most stable mindset to pull, you know, working 20 hours a day on this game.
Yeah, well, we need to talk about that aspect of it, I think, because that was the thing, I guess, viewing this from my lofty adult viewpoint. I really want to know who at Tuckersoft is handling the project management end of things, because you certainly do not let a 19-year-old kid of questionable stability come in off the street, pitch you a game, and then buy it and give him a tight deadline and no help.
Yeah, so I guess if we're timing this out, though, this is what, 1984? Again, very fun. very fun reference to the year that it was, considering the piece of pop culture based around it and this idea of Big Brother. This is what, 2 years after E.T. and the big video game crash? So I guess that at this point, like, I guess we can sort of compare it to Tuckersoft to like a startup where they have a couple of successful things, but really they're more about building this community. I mean, Mohad Thacker is just a big idea man and he's a money man, considering that he's able to rock a beige suit and probably has a big closet full of them. I think indicates that this man is loaded and he's willing to let everyone know about it. But to that point, he doesn't seem to have the best business acumen, considering that he sinks so much equity into this one game of Bandersnatch that there were a bunch of endings where, because things go belly up, so does the company. Even though we can talk about maybe the company doesn't go completely belly up. But yeah, their business practices are shifty at best, but I wonder if that's just because the market at that point was so bottomed out and Thacker was just happy that he found the golden goose that was Colin Rittman. He's like, yeah, you know what? I'll just bring in everybody. I love video games. Video games are great. We're making a Motown of video games. We're going to be wearing solid gold underwear from all the video games we're selling.
What does that even mean?
It's the 80s. Doesn't need to make any sense.
I guess not. He's got a fever and the only prescription is more video games. But that's, that may be true, but it also seems like they're putting a lot of faith in this kid, and that game is supposed to be amazing. But I see like kind of three entire departments where you need three different people that are very good at their jobs. You can't just be one guy doing all of the things. He can be the guy that writes it. He can be the guy that is responsible for the technical application, or he can be the guy that's responsible for the artistic direction. You don't have one person be all those things. Your product's going to be inferior if you have no input from other people. It's not like, maybe the runty little kid on the video game show thinks that having something designed by committee makes it worse. But honestly, you need people to specialize if it's something this huge and ambitious. And that Tuckersoft didn't see this means they deserve to go under.
Yeah, I think that unfortunately, maybe this, you know, Stefan's willingness to go back and change things unfortunately befell from just a lack of critical resources at the time. Frankly, I'm very surprised that a British seems like a new show in the 80s, was willing to dedicate an entire segment to video game reviews. It's absolutely bananas to me that they said, like, let's make a Roger and Ebert for an entire, you know, medium that is basically on the fritz right now to review things and have their opinion matter. I feel like if Bandersnatch was made nowadays as like an indie game from this, you know, one guy, I feel like you check IGN, you check Metacritic, you have multiple sources that you can utilize. It's just, you know, this is not really an internet age that we live in, so he wasn't able to look up the second opinions. He unfortunately bases everything off of this one, you know, snidely looking guy. I mean, when he says, oh, I'm giving this 4 out of 5 because nothing's perfect, like, that's just a horrible way to look at things personally. Like, you can't be that teacher who constantly gives everyone B's because you think they can do better at some point. Like, if it's A work, give it an A. Come on, man.
You sound like you're maybe projecting some of your personal experiences onto this, Mike.
Hell yeah, that's what this is all about.
I guess this show is supposed to be a black mirror, if you will, reflecting yourself back onto yourself. And I think you nailed it, though. This is ridiculous that everyone is so consumed with what this kid says when it's clear that everything comes out of his mouth is garbage. And Stefan should have seen that the first time he said that, been like, I don't need to base my self-worth on this one kid. Like, maybe I'll go read some of the trades. Maybe someone else gave it a good review. Maybe I don't need to murder anybody.
Maybe. But on that note, in terms of, teaming up to do things, because it is interesting that the message they're sort of putting out in a weird manner of speaking is, you know, forget no man is an island. You know, Colin puts this of like, hey, if you have a crazy idea, you've got to work on it by yourself so it doesn't get polluted by anybody else. We even see it where even though Stefan and Colin seem to be on the same page, and the outcome where Stefan ends up jumping off the balcony, Colin ends up running away with the game, and it becomes just the slew of adjectives that nerd describes it as, right? Of like dark and depressing and weird and mortifying in true Colin fashion. And I think, again, this is sort of like Thacker is listening to Colin because Colin is the guy who is putting money in his pockets, basically, and putting his name out there on the map, who basically gives him the advice of, yeah, you know what? He can work on his own. He says behind his weird, like, Hunter S. Thompson glasses and, I don't know, like, 90s boy band-esque spiked hair. But I think that, in theory, the initial approach was a good one of, hey, let's bring this guy and have him work in his team. Not only will it reduce his workload, but it also gives an opportunity to, like, bring him into our company, not just have him be this weirdo freelancer we have to sort of keep tracking down in person and on phone to get him on the deadline.
Yeah, and if Colin's so much of an ideological purist, what's he doing finishing the game for Stefan after Stefan kills himself?
It's true. Yeah, when he's talking about, like, it has to be this one guy's vision. I don't know, maybe he was still tripped out on acid when he made the decision to accept it. Maybe he was spending too much money on Pearl and just needed some more dough in his pocket. I'm not entirely sure, but yeah, it's an interesting statement on the nature of creativity. And I mean, you do wonder, since everything is an analog for something else, if Charlie Brooker, since I believe this was written by Charlie Brooker, was Charlie Brooker trying to make a veiled statement towards some of his fellow Black Mirror writers of like, this is my kooky concept, and if we want some good material, I'm going to have to work on this one on my own.
Has anybody checked on Charlie Brooker's dad recently?
Oh no, Mr. Brooker, I hope everything's okay.
Yeah, I hope so. So I think that's kind of most of the stories. I think all of the endings kind of fall into one of two buckets. It's either Stefan dies or Stefan kills his father, or there's this third ending that we haven't really talked about, which I think is potentially one of the more interesting paths you can go down. And that would be the Netflix ending.
Mm-hmm. Again, if we're talking about breaking down the fourth wall, this breaks down like the fourth wall and then the wall behind that wall going into the next apartment. Like, it is going clean through any building that you're sitting in, because the biggest laugh, in my opinion, comes from Stefan. You know, this is when he's really starting to unravel or become wise and looks up and asks, who are you? Give me a sign. You have the choice between the glyph that represents Jerome Davis sort of succumbing to his own crazy fantasies and multiple realities, which, depending on when you watch it, you might not necessarily know about, Or it says Netflix. And I'll admit, I let out a huge guffaw when I saw this, but little did I know what would happen if and when you chose to talk about Netflix to a man who is living in a world, you know, almost 35 years before this story takes place.
Yeah, is Netflix a planet?
I mean, as she says while she's wearing all red and a nice little, like, wink, wink, nudge, nudge to her, you know, her brand loyalty.
Yeah, it's really fantastic, the conversation that you have where you try to explain what Netflix is, or, you know, quote unquote, you. And it also kind of ties back into, like, how much of this is happening in Stefan's head and how much of it is, are we meant to believe, is, like, happening. When he goes and talks to his dad and his dad says, no, come on, son, you can tell me anything. And he says, I'm being controlled by someone from the future. And his dad's like, all right, let's go to the psychiatrist.
Yeah, but to his point, Stefan is not irate, paranoid Stefan here, where he goes, yeah, I like that. And that's when maybe it's just because he's certain as to what might befall. But man, I mean, again, this episode had this movie had a lot of things. Did not think a Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon-esque fight between Stefan and his psychiatrist would be in the realm of possibility.
Well, the thing I have to ask you, Mike, is did it freak you out when you got to the jump out the window ending and the first thing that happens after he jumps out the window is somebody says, Mike?
Yes, because I think that was when I was watching that was when my wife walked through the door and said the exact same thing. And that's when I truly felt like this is over. All right. This is when the lights come down, the curtains come up, and it's revealed that my life is one big show. It explains a lot. So unfortunately, that was where, you know, art definitely mimicked reality for that one split second. But yeah, that was weird because it wasn't even a break of the fourth wall into the real world. Right. The Stefan is played by, God, I'm going to butcher his name. Finn.
I think it's just Finn.
God, damn vowels. Finn Whitehead. So I think that, you know, had you called him Finn, that would, you know, I guess make more sense that it sort of breaks into a mockumentary. But the fact that he's called Mike, the actor who plays his dad is a director, which connects back to the pack of it all, that, you know, he's a director of another sort, sort of watching over his actions and instructing him what to do. That definitely, I would say it's the most fun thing. I would say even more fun than kicking your dad in the balls and having Stefan essentially look at you and say, oh, did you have fun with that ending? Basically, I liked how trippy this one got, because again, it harkens a lot back to, as well, to something like White Bear, where the entire thing is one big ruse, except in this case, rather than a purposeful psychological manipulation, this is just a poor actor who pulled a Daniel Day-Lewis and got too method.
Well, I think that segues into something else that I think I would like to talk about. Well, there's two branches, there's two paths we can go down, of course. I would love to talk about some of the fan theories that are coming up around the strategy behind, like, how you get to certain areas. And I would also like to talk about all of the myriad nods to the Black Mirror universe that take place within this episode.
Yeah, let's talk about that. I mean, I guess to start, I can't remember if we've talked about this on the podcast proper, Jess. How do you feel about the theories that I've been going around that the episodes of Black Mirror are not only all connected, but may take place in the same universe / timeline?
I think it gets kind of precious sometimes. If you ask me, like, some of them are a little bit of a stretch, but I also think it's a fun thing to watch out for. And it was like, every minute there was something new in Bandersnatch. It was like, oh, he goes to St. Juniper's Medical Center and Dr. Haynes has the same name as Rollo Haynes in the Black Museum. And oh, that's the White Bear glyph. And oh, look, there's a big poster for a game called Valdak's Revenge. It was relentless.
Yeah, I mean, from the very first thing where you see Metalhead in the background, and even though they try to go, you know, fun and futuristic and remove vowels, unlike Finn Whitehead's name, it's a little heavy-handed, but it's also interesting going off of the heels of Black Museum, which I believe you and I and Rob talked about as being very reference-heavy as well. I mean, I guess to sort of answer my own question, I don't know how I feel about it. Maybe it's because we sort of live in a world where it is fun, but also a bit extra to constantly connect pieces of pop culture. I mean, the Pixar theory has been going for years and years and movies at this point, if you're talking about like really making a stretch in terms of connecting pieces of pop culture, I sort of like this as just an anthology. You know, it's just a bunch of like one-off stories that take place in completely different universes. I would rather not have them sacrifice things narratively in an effort to make everything make sense as it's connected, you know, rather than just sort of give themselves a bunch of different pieces of white paper that exist in different planes of existence and color in them, no matter how much you may worry about, you know, what the other kids are doing on their other pieces of paper.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes a kid might have something that looks very similar to what you've got, but it doesn't mean that all of the pieces of paper are connected.
Yeah, exactly. Like they might be looking off of each other and saying, oh, yeah, that's fun. I'm going to draw it in this way, which is just more inspiration than it is connection. So, I mean, I can understand. I mean, this is a show that is fraught with analysis. I mean, that's why we are doing this podcast. But I'm hopeful that it doesn't mean we're going to get one big sort of Black Mirror unifying theory. But considering the circumstances of this episode in particular, I might be personally going down the wrong path here with that thought.
Let me just say that if we get to a series finale of Black Mirror and it zooms out to show an autistic kid with a snow globe, I'm going to like throw my TV out the window.
Yeah, but then it's going to like zoom out and like the autistic kid is being monitored by these people and the people are being monitored by the government. Like it's just going to be a Russian nesting dolls of people watching other people.
Yep. And then like every fifth one is a snow globe and a kid, and it just keeps going out and out and out and out.
Yeah. And then then it's also going to have like every 10th one is going to be like Rafe Spall still in the snow globe from the Christmas episode.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it does get a little bit. I don't want to have to put every single episode of Black Mirror together, like have to think about like Daniel Kaluuya on the bike is also like rating Bryce Dallas Howard on Nosedive. And they when they die, they all go to San Junipero. I don't want to have to keep all these things together in my head. I want it to be like I could watch one of these episodes and enjoy it and watch another one of these episodes and be like, aha, they made a joke about the other episode. But I don't want to necessarily have to have my entire enjoyment of the series dependent on me getting all the jokes.
Now, that being said, this might be one of the biggest ones that is not only directly connected to other episodes, but from what I caught, it seems like it actually might be setting things up as to how certain technologies become the way they are in other episodes.
Well, Mike, you've learned from me now that the choice you just made was not a choice at all.
Mm-hmm.
I said we could choose between the talking about the unified Black Mirror universe, or we could talk about the fan theories. It turns out we're talking about them both.
Yes. I mean, look, we are completionists, at least as much as we can with Bandersnatch. I'm assuming we're going to explore everything. So I think, you know, it makes sense that we sort of spread a wide net and tried to bring in as much metaphoric fish as we could.
Yeah, very true. So, yeah, I think there's some elements in here that suggest that other technology in the Black Mirror universe is all coming together around this.
Mm-hmm.
I think in particular, one of the most interesting fan theories I read was the one that suggests that Stefan might be possibly being tortured in the White Bear simulation for killing his father.
Right. So it was mentioned before, but for those of you that might not remember, so the white glyph that Jerome F. Davies sort of carves onto his walls and his dead wife's blood, and that Stefan is also carving into the jail cell when you the many, many times, assumingly, that you try to bury his father and end up getting caught, whether it's by the police or that damn German shepherd from next door. You know, in this one, it sort of indicates a divergent branching path. But I believe I haven't seen White Bear in a while, but I believe that's sort of like the main glyph that keeps appearing with that woman as she sort of walks through this reality that she doesn't know how she wound up in.
Yeah, it's the same glyph. And that glyph shows up in quite a few other episodes. Like, I know for certain it's in Playtest. And it's something that kind of crops up from time to time. It's almost starting to become the symbol of Black Mirror.
And the interesting thing about Playtest, which is probably the most comparable episode to this, in that it's another video game-based episode. And it's also sort of, that one is more directly along the lines of, is this a simulation or is this happening in real life? But I believe from what I read that someone was actually reading a magazine that had Bandersnatch on the cover of it. So I believe, again, if we're putting this out begrudgingly so in the timeline of things, this took place before playtests, and who knows, maybe it would lead to the technology that would end up putting, you know, our poor mother-loving man into his unfortunate time with spiders.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. And of course, if we're really thinking about it, Bandersnatch takes place before all of the Black Mirror events, because most of the Black Mirror episodes take place in like a not too distant future. And this one takes place in 1984.
Yep, that's true, though. I don't know. Black Mirror season 5 might have like a caveman episode of Black Mirror that just shows them off completely. On the note of White Bear, I believe from when I was researching that actually the company that funded White Bear is TCKR. Now, we know that Tuckersoft ends up going under, but I would bet dollars to donuts that maybe in this universe, Mohan Thacker is at it again. He's going to use that technology in a different way, and he helps sort of build or use his funds and software in a different way to build this absolutely horrifying form of capital punishment.
I could see it happening. And TCKR is also the company that creates the giant data center where people live in San Junipero.
There you go. So maybe Mohan Thacker becomes like, I don't know, the Elon Musk, where he's trying to do good in the world, in a manner of speaking.
Yeah, or at least make the world more interesting.
And also, it's interesting that, that I believe in San Junipero, isn't the bar that they go to named Tucker's? Which, again,
it certainly is.
Would be Mohan Thacker, like, putting his stamp on each and every part of his own IP, no matter where you may be.
Yeah, it's either him or his next of kin. Maybe this is the universe in which Stefan kills him.
Yeah, that's true. And maybe his poor little ponytailed children will, much like Pearl, grow up and learn to sort of like sow their father's seeds.
Very possible. I think almost anything is possible. And there are certainly, I think it's fun to take one episode at a time and connect them back. And you could drive yourself insane watching the crawl at the bottom of the Pearl ending.
Mm-hmm.
Because every single one of those things, if you don't recognize it, you're probably going to recognize it as soon as the rest of the season drops.
Yeah, it's basically like I've watched a lot of BoJack Horseman that I'm used to sort of half paying attention to what's being said while also reading the bottom of the screen. But yeah, I'll admit, again, it's been a while since I've watched some of these season 1 and 2 episodes. It took me a few seconds to connect some names, but I would love to hear from you, Jess. I don't know if you have a laundry list available of some connections that were made, since as we talked about, it's a lot.
It is a lot. And I would just encourage people to go back and look, because every single one of them, like, it means something different and new. And I know on Reddit, people have made a whole list of them. I didn't write any down personally, but I had to watch it a couple of times because I kept being distracted and I know I was missing a lot.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot going on, especially the first time when you watch that ending. And, you know, if you're talking about time jumps, that's the first time that it jumps forward, where it does. If we're talking about snow globes and snow globes, where it shows, old nerdy, what's his name, Robin, I think, and his 5-star game review fade out to like a Dateline-esque show of, oh, yes, actually, it turns out that, hey, this entire time, the guy who brilliantly designed this game actually murdered his father. And then it cuts to this entirely different news story. So it's understandable that you would be distracted the first time. But if you're able to make it all the way through again, definitely pay attention to that lower crawl, because it's hinting at all of this news that pervades the Black Mirror universe at large.
Yeah, and I think some of it is just sort of like they have the Oceanic Airlines showing up in shows that are not Lost.
Yeah, or like the Let's potato chips that show up in a bunch of different comedy shows of the 2000s.
Yep, or John Munch showing up on every show apart from Homicide.
Yeah, exactly. Basically, it's like, I think it's more of a fun unifier than it is just sort of like this means that all the universes are connected. And it's a nice way for the show to also look back on its legacy. It's crazy to think about in 8 years where the show has come from, this sort of like, I don't know, cult show that only people that were the biggest Anglophiles were into something that has become sort of like Netflix must watches, now culminating in this big feature film, which I don't think Charlie Brooker ever thought he would do back in the early 2010s. So I think it's fun when the show looks back on itself. Again, it's really interesting how the last episode we watched does the exact same thing. I don't know if this means that this is just going to be more of an Ouroboros-like show where it just keeps eating its own tail. I'm hopeful that it isn't because I love the legacy of Black Mirror, but I love to see new stories too.
Yeah, and I think the only way forward is to create new stories. Like, we can't just keep folding back on ourselves like this. But it is interesting to think back on the first season of Black Mirror, the first two seasons, actually, where it was just something that people would kind of whisper to you about. And you'd be like, oh, really? That's a thing? There was a whole show about getting the prime minister to do that to a pig. And then from there, where we've gone has been really interesting, and it's a little galling to those of us that watched those seasons before they caught on. And now it's like everybody talks about Black Mirror. It's like, but I was there first, and it's easy to be a very big hipster about it.
Well, yeah, and I think that, you know, it's also interesting that, you know, it's gained a good amount of budget. You know, it's brought in a lot of, from their perspective, international actors, a lot of American actors specifically have gotten involved. None in this episode. It goes back to British actors at its core. But it's so interesting to watch, you know, how things have sort of segued and how technology has segued as well. There's been a lot of Black Mirror predicted this stuff going on. And also, you mean the output as well. The first two seasons were, what, 3 episodes each? You had the Christmas special, and then seasons 3 and 4 were each 6 episodes. We're getting this movie. I'm assuming we're going to get another 6 episodes sometime later in the year. Like, that's 3 times the output in the course of 5 years than the show did in its first 5 years. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's a lot of content. I feel like it took me like a month to get through the first 3 episodes. And now it's like, we're just going to drop them all on you at once and you need to watch them in 2 days.
Yeah, it's very true. Because now we also live in a culture where I think we're excitedly talking about it, which is also really fun as well. Even though, you know, I think if we're talking about, again, named doppelgangers facing off against each other, between this and Bird Box, I think a lot of people that utilize their Netflix accounts have been very confused the past couple weeks as to what memes people are talking about.
Well, I think my favorite thing about that I saw on Twitter was somebody that said, wasn't Bird Box Bandersnatch the guy that played Doctor Strange?
That might be another connection as well. Again, speaking towards the British aspects of it all, maybe it's an outward reference to Benedict Cumberbatch. Though it also is interesting talking to pop culture references outside of Black Mirror that between the title, yes, I know it's an actual canceled game, but between Bandersnatch, actually going through the Looking Glass, the White Rabbit of it all, a lot of Alice in Wonderland imagery in this movie, Jess.
Yeah, they're definitely. I liked the way that it all kept tying together. Like, even you might even argue there's like a little bit of the eat me, drink me thing going on.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, especially the LSD connections as well, giving Lewis Carroll's certain vices. Some have said that, you know, Kitty's makeup is not unlike that of specifically the Johnny Depp version of the Mad Hatter from the Tim Burton movies. And again, if you're talking about someone sort of going through an adventure that can be perceived as a dream, I mean, again, the way that I perceive what I would call the quote unquote good ending where he goes back, gets on the train and dies, I actually take that as a sign that all that was happening, at least in this universe, when Colin goes to sit down and talk to Dr. Haynes for the first time sequentially in this episode, he closes his eyes. It all happens in his head and he dies as a result in that timeline. So essentially that entire story, if you take that ending, takes place over the course of like maybe a 30-second gap where maybe he's a bit sleep deprived. He's seeing his psychiatrist. He closes his eyes. All this happens. Maybe his brain hemorrhages for one reason or another. And then he dies. And again, going back to Alice in Wonderland, where it turns out in one perspective to be a dream the entire time, it talks about sort of like the hallucinogenic powers of the mind and how it may have an effect on your own physical well-being.
And that's also goes back to playtest again.
Yeah, very true. Where, you know, what you may be experiencing in your head is going to have a profound impact on your body. Granted, that was more so, I think, from the actual equipment itself, but it does still, I mean, I thought immediately of playtest when I experienced the ending where Colin ends up, or Stefan ends up dying in the psychiatrist's office, where again, it's just a young video game enthusiast dying in a chair. Seems very familiar.
Yeah. And that, of course, goes all the way back to Total Recall.
Yes, that's very true as well as to, you know, did he actually go to Mars or was he just sitting in that chair the entire time?
I guess we'll never know. But there are a couple more fan theories that I think are really interesting to talk about, especially with regard to is there extra content out there that has not been accounted for at this point? I think you and I, between the two of us, as having spent as much time as we have watching this, and between the two of us and what everybody has come up with on Reddit, I would imagine if there's something else out there to be discovered, we would have discovered it by now, right?
Yeah, I mean, you would think so. I think that we have discovered all the major endings, which I can sort of, you know, go down the line here. We talked about the train one. We talked about the 5-star one. There's Stefan jumps out the window. There's Stefan accepts the offer immediately. There are several endings where it's, you know, Stefan kills his dad and gets discovered and goes to jail. So those are basically like the main ones with a couple of different permutations. I think if we're missing anything, it's these small changes that happen when you replay scenes, when you jump back to them, where characters might say subtly different things. I think that, you know, I had heard that the optimal way to sort of get, quote unquote, all the endings is to just let Netflix play and don't make any decisions. It's sort of like the Luigi wins by doing nothing of Netflix, where you just don't touch anything and let it play out. And it does take a longer time than a typical hour and a half that it takes to watch Bandersnatch while making decisions, but you pretty much get all, you know, hit all the major points. But what you do miss out on are those opportunities where you go back and the characters at least are sort of time jumping ones, and Stefan and Colin you know, make mention of the fact that they've been here before. Those might be the smaller things that even us on the internet a few days after this is released still have not peeked into. And in fact, I guess the creators also said in an interview, they proposed that there was one scene that even they could not get to, which I don't know how that works, but I guess, you know, I'm liable to believe them in this case.
Yeah, well, that also, that's the other choose your own adventure nod that I think we have to discuss here. There was one particular book, and I don't know if this was one you ever read, Mike. It was called Inside UFO 5440. Mm. Does this ring a bell?
I think that might have been one I took a glance at. I was not really into aliens when I was a kid, so if we're talking about like comparisons between that and the history stuff, I was going for the history stuff 100%.
Oh, me too. Like the Statue of Liberty one is a modern classic, but the UFO 5440 book involved, you would go onto the UFO and you were trying to reach this mythical utopia, and every choice you made was supposed to push you closer to the utopia. But the trick in that book was there was an ending that you could not reach from any other path in the book. You had to get there by cheating. So you would just open the book and find that page, and it would say, hey, you know, not everything can be reached in a logical fashion, and, you know, congratulations, you found utopia, but the only way to get to the utopian ending was to cheat. Mm. And I think that has to be something on the minds of Charlie Brooker and co. as they were putting this all together.
Right, and that goes back to the video games of it all. Maybe when you're prompted to enter 20541, which I thought was a really interesting moment as well. How many times did repeating that phrase make you realize just what you were supposed to put in?
I cheated. At that point, that was about the fifth or sixth ending that we got. And at that point, I'd already been on Reddit, so I knew what to put in.
Okay, because I had I was a bit confused when it cuts between all these scenes of like Colin being like, grab a pen, listen closely. But I'm glad that they sort of did the sort of dental plan Lisa needs braces of it all, where they just like kept repeating it over and over again, like, okay, this makes sense. But I do feel like maybe if you enter some sort of different, like the version of the Konami code in there, maybe it unlocks that deleted scene. Because, yeah, to your point, maybe it's something that needs to be accessed via, you know, hacking the system, as it were. Maybe it's someone needs to actually go in there, hack this branch manager software that they created only for this movie to get there. Otherwise, it's inaccessible.
Yeah, and I think that's what people on Reddit have been trying to do. And there's a few things that they've found by breaking down the code. Like someone posts the JSON file of all the timestamps of everything that happens in there. And one thing they have concluded is that there's nothing hard-coded into that scene with the phone number and the therapist that suggests there's anything else that will happen. You either press the wrong number and you go to jail, or you call the therapist and you make the threat. And they said that there's no actual coded path that takes you to anything else, but there's also a few other things that people have had to extract in really strange ways. Like, for instance, there's a secret ending where you go back to the bus and Stefan puts in a tape that says Bandersnatch, and he's listening to the tape that is his code.
Mm.
And you can take that signal and you can compress it into a QR code that takes you to a website for Tuckersoft.
And apparently, isn't that the one that also takes you to, like, there's an accessible version of Nosedive that you can play? Of course, again, spelled in that fun little 80s style way, but you can only play it on, like, a certain emulator.
Yep, you have to download the emulator. And also, people have reported that the games that are listed on Tuckersoft's website change according to how much of Bandersnatch you have seen.
Oh.
So sometimes Nosedive is not available, and sometimes other ones are, and sometimes Bandersnatch is canceled, and sometimes it's not.
Wow. That is super connected / very fearful about my internet overlords that they're able to connect this website to my Netflix viewing history.
Well, Mike, do you remember season 2 of Lost? And I don't know if you were a Lost head in real time, like I was. You were, what, 13 when that came out?
I was 15. Are you talking about the Hanso Foundation website?
This was before that, even. There was something that somebody found. You would get really deep into the message boards, and someone can dig this up again, but someone found a website that they thought must have been set up by the makers of Lost, and it just, like, they would find code after code in the, like, they'd go in the source code and they'd find something and there'd be like a binary thing, and it got very, very deep. And then it turned out it was completely random and not related to Lost in any way.
Oh boy. Yeah, that's always fun as well. I mean, again, that's how we are as pop culture enthusiasts. I love it, but we are also rife with overanalysis. I'm looking at the Tuckersoft website right now, and there's, again, wow, some really fun references here. We have Roach Busters in reference to the Army episode, Men Against Fire,
Men Against Fire.
Yes, exactly. Terror on Rannoch B. I can't tell if that's a USS Callister thing or if that's a reference to something else. Rolling Road, which, does that have something to do with a bike?
No, Rolling Road is the game that they play in 15 Million Merits.
Oh, yes, the cycling game. Yes, yes, yes. Pig in a poke, self-explanatory. Yeah. Valdak's Revenge, you mentioned before, and then there's actually a game called White Bear.
Oh, that's a game I'm not going to play.
A great icebreaker of a game of skill. Escape the flying ice blocks over and over, and remember to beware of the white bear.
Yeah, I'll hard pass.
Yeah, so, and there's even a job listing here as well. So there's a lot of fun little nods in here. I also heard that there was, like, actual fake Tuckersoft ads that were posted around England, sort of like, I don't know if you experienced this, Jess, in New York City, but I remember around the time Stranger Things 2 season 2 came out, there were fake ads around the city for the Hawkins Electric Company. So I feel like, you know, England sort of got their side of the fake advertisement, but God, do I love the immersion. This is a lot of fun, and this is also going to drive people crazy, just tearing apart the code for the next several months. Hopefully this will keep people busy for enough time before season 5 comes out.
Yeah, I think you could get pretty deeply entrenched in it. If you really wanted to spend the time, you can go down some pretty deep rabbit holes. And I don't know if it involves, I don't know if that all ends with you age 5 dying on a train with your mother, but personally, I wouldn't chance it.
Yeah, I would say, you know, I'm good sticking in the timeline that I'm in right now. You know, it has its qualms, but you know what? I think it's much better than the alternative.
Yes, indeed. So speaking of people that get deeply entrenched in things, before we wrap up, do we want to take a couple of questions from our Rob Has a Podcast patron group?
Absolutely. People out there, send us a sign. Where should we go?
Oh, who is responsible for this? Who's doing this to me?
Yes, exactly. My hand is going to the mouse right now so I can look at the questions.
All right. So, yeah, choice one, wrap up the podcast. Choice two, kill Mike. I think we'll skip that one.
It's okay. If you do the latter, I think you are fulfilling a fantasy that several people out there on the internet have wanted to do for some time. So at least they can live vicariously through you, much like we live vicariously through Stefan, for better or for worse.
Well, I'm sure in another timeline, you open up the podcast and you show back up again eventually. So let's start it off with this great question I thought from Andrea Raffle, who says, I thought the Choose Your Own Adventure was a cool concept, especially for a show like Black Mirror. What I'm torn on is that if it was the episode or this Choose Your Own Adventure that made me feel like there were no real consequences for the choice that I and Stefan were making. Making the choice to kill your father or tell your friend to jump off of a building should have a strong reaction from you, but it just felt empty because if it was the wrong choice, you could have just gone back. And when it was the right choice, it's like, oh, I guess it wasn't that bad to do since it kept the story going. The choices felt empty. Am I the only one feeling this way?
Interesting. So sort of what she's proposing is there isn't an option to go back once an ending plays out. And it's more so that this particular string plays out and then you go back to the very beginning and then you sort of make the choices that you want to.
Yeah. And I think that was also my gripe with the Choose Your Own Adventure books back in the day. It was like, yeah, well, whatever I do, at a certain point, you get a little jaded by it. It's like, oh, I could die here, but I'll just flip back and do it all over again. And it's true. The first playthrough, I was really conscious. I wanted the best thing for Stefan. And when it came down to, you know, is he going to jump off or is he going to kill Colin? I felt like that was, I don't want either one of them to die. Can we just like step back and maybe have some more tea and listen to some trippy electronica? But no, one of them's got to die. And I'm like, no, I want the option to take the pills. I want to go work at the company. I just want him to have a good life. And I keep ruining it.
Listen, maybe Colin should have gone, because I don't know if you saw his eyes, but they were not in the best shape. So it might have been best to just sort of end it all for him. But I think that I can understand that point in terms of like getting jaded by going back so many times. But that being said, I was getting jaded by going back to the beginning and listening to that introductory stuff so many times. I'll be honest, I understand where she's coming from. I don't know if I would have the patience to watch those first 10 minutes again and again and again to go down all the permutations that I wanted to. I thought it was a saving grace to have those montages happen each and every time. You just sort of skip through the major events because I'm here for the yada yada of it all.
Yeah, agreed. And of course, you do it enough times and apparently Colin shows up and does it for you, which is kind of fun, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. Let's see. I'm looking for another question and giving Steve something to do in the editing. Let's see. We covered a lot of this, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It was really helpful to all of you who put the questions in to give us some good jumping off points, even if we're not exactly getting to your exact questions here. I think I'm going to go with Edwin Johnson wants to know, is this a new evolution of the viewing experience or is this a flash in the pan fad?
It's a good question. I mean, I think this is essentially us predicting, like, when are we going to see this again? I feel like it was buzzed about enough not to make a Hate It in the Nation reference. It was buzzed about enough to, I think, warrant another try. At least I hope it is, because again, I really like the concept. I think the material behind it can be stronger, and I think it will if there's more confidence behind it. But I also wouldn't be surprised if Black Mirror tries out a bunch of different things, and a lot of things work. I think any other creators could be like, yeah, let's go back to the USS Callister. Like, that's so fun. We'll have them go back for another season. But I think Brooker is almost about like living in the unconventionality of it all, making sure that every story he tells is extremely different. So while I would be totally fine with it, I could imagine a timeline where he says, well, that was fun. I don't want to do that again. I want to keep my audience on their toes. Let's move on and do another thing.
Yeah. Or to your point, rewinding way back to the beginning of the podcast, you noted that maybe this is the template for something even bigger and more complex.
Yeah, it's very true. Also, speaking of Hayden and the Nation, just to clear up the missing game reference from the list on the Tuckersoft website, Ian Ranuck, as in the game that Terror on Ranuck B, I believe it's that's the reference to a character from White Bear and Hated in the Nation, one of the guys who is part of the kidnapping with White Bear's main character, Victoria, and they also make a brief reference to him in Hated in the Nation as well, which we've heard about the White Bear references. Hidden in the Nation, a very small reference to an episode that is nearly the length of Bandersnatch. Very interesting.
I appreciate you being thorough here in service of us not getting added.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to happen anyway, which I'm totally fine to service those who will add us, because then you're sort of willing us to make certain decisions as well. Again, if I was not apprehensive of being added, I would not be pushed towards making that decision to look into Terror on Ranuck B. So, you know what? It all works out for a reason.
Yeah, I mean, something always compels me after I listen to a podcast. Like, I feel like I'm driven by an invisible force to at people, and I have to really fight it.
Yeah, and again, that connects back to Hated in the Nation, because when you send that hate tweet, then you know that eventually the bees will come after you, Jess.
Yeah, and nobody wants bees.
No, not the bees.
No, not the bees. Okay. Well, I think we've covered almost every question that people asked, and I want to thank people again for leaving those comments. And if you want to be a part of the discussion, I think the best way to do that is to become a patron of Rob as a Podcast / Post Show Recaps. And we have some great discussions going on in our Facebook group every day. So I invite people to do that. I think it's a really great way to waste your time on the internet. Since we are all, as Black Mirror continually admonishes us, we are all plugged in all the time, and it's ruining our lives.
Yeah, which again is like counterintuitive, because it's like, hey, consume our digital content, but also shame on you for consuming digital content and letting it rule your lives. But it's that tricky balance that I love so much about the show and will love about the show, hopefully when it comes back in not too long for season 5.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping. I keep hearing April, but we'll see what happens. And at any rate, when that happens, Mike and I and the rest of the Post Show Recaps team will be covering it on sort of a rotating basis, I think. You'll get 2 or 3 of us on each episode breaking down everything that happens, and we can all ruin our lives together.
Yeah, exactly. We're all in the same boat. We're all walking on the same path together, turning and facing down this demon-like thing before the things promptly crash on us and we have to start all over again. But that's the fun of it all in the community. And like Jess said, I'm really thankful for this community as well. Not only the RHAP community, which is absolutely fantastic, but the Reddit community as well, who has been so super obsessive. Again, this episode is only like 4 days old from the time we're recording this, but already so much stuff is out there that it really makes it exciting to pore over each and every detail with all these other uber-obsessive Black Mirror nerds.
I rate you all 5 stars.
Oh, thank goodness. Now, no need to nosedive. No emulators downloaded. Keep Colin's work unplayed.
Yeah, that's right. So, Mike Bloom, do you have anything else you want to share with people about what you're up to apart from ruining your life with technology?
Sure. So, from a scripted television perspective, I am going to be covering the 2nd season of Star Trek Discovery for The Hollywood Reporter on a recurring basis, which I know, Jess, you and Rob are very excited to be covering. I know you guys are working through some Short Trek stuff right now. At the time of recording this, the final episode of Short Treks will be released on Thursday, January 3rd, and I have a really fun postmortem article that should be going up that night, an interview with Rainn Wilson, who not only stars in but directs that episode, which, for my money, don't want to build up expectations, might be my favorite Short Treks episode of the 4. And so be sure to also check out some weekly stuff I have going on there for Star Trek Discovery proper in a couple weeks. I'm also doing exit press for Top Chef, Celebrity Big Brother, and so much more for Parade Magazine. From a podcast perspective, the winter season is all about Top Chef and RuPaul's Drag Race for me, though I'm sure we'll also throw in some other nonsense from time to time as we segue eventually into the Survivor season come February. You can follow all the stuff that I'm putting out there, either in podcast form or article form, on my Twitter at @MikeBloomType. And thank you all for listening. And Jess, thank you so much for having me on. I was happy to be alongside the ride here for you as we sort of wended our way back and forth through this weird roller coaster.
Yeah, I think this was certainly the best possible timeline, Mike.
Aw, thank you. No goatee, so I know it's not the worst.
I didn't, but, you know, the night is still young. We'll see where it takes me. And with all of that, you can follow me on Twitter at Haymaker Hattie, and you can follow Post Show Recaps on Twitter, Facebook, and all of your favorite social media sites for all of the latest television coverage. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. And with that, Mike and I are going to go scribble some glyphs on all the walls of our respective rooms. Good night, everybody, and thanks.
Special thanks to our friends over at True Car for sponsoring this episode of Post Show Recaps. Every car comes with its share of stories. That ding in your bumper when you nervously picked up your first date, that luxury package you got after that big promotion, or the mileage you save by riding your bike all summer long. And while you can't put a price tag on your stories, now with True Car, you could at least find out what your car is worth when it's time to sell it or trade it in. Just go to True Car, simply enter your license plate number, and watch how your car's details pop up. Then answer a few questions. Navigation and moonroof? Sure, they'll bump up your value. High mileage, you already knew it was going to cost you, but find how much it's going to ding your wallet so you can plan ahead. And once you're finished, you'll get a true cash offer sent in minutes, which you can take to a local certified dealer to cash out or trade in. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out True Car today. True cash offer not available in all areas.